Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today I have with me in the studio Port Townsend resident Tess Taft. As an oncology stress management specialist and family therapist who has served cancer patients and their loved ones in hospitals, cancer clinics, homes, nursing homes, hospices, and private practice settings for 40 years, she has published the book Calming the Emotional Storm of Breast Cancer and has had chapters published in two additional books, Living and Thriving with Lung Cancer and Living and Thriving with Pancreas Cancer. She has more books to come and she'll tell us about them. She is committed to serving people whose life-threatening diagnosis or that of a love has propelled them on a journey inside themselves to find emotional and spiritual healing and peace. She comes to this work after earning a master's degree in social work from the University of Washington in 1979 and a marriage and family therapy training program in 1981. She became a certified specialist in interactive guided imagery for medical clinicians in order to teach clients this unique and powerful tool to help with symptom and stress management and to explore and deepen hope and well-being. Welcome to the program, Tess.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you're here. You've got a big smile and you seem like a really calm person. And one of the things I want to ask you about is not only your books, but how writing might play a part in helping you center with all of the sadness that you must experience and stress in clients.
Well, people often wonder about how I manage the sadness and the stress, but I don't feel sad or stressful because what I'm doing helps me feel useful. So I think a lot of people assume that there's great sadness, but there's great hope. And hope is something that never dies. It just changes. Hmm. So as people go through a cancer experience, diagnosis, the shock of that, and then the predictable crisis points in cancer, which are diagnosis, beginning treatment, midway through treatment, which is a time when people can't move forward, but they can't go back. And they don't know how they're going to find the energy to keep getting treatment. And then ending treatment when all the soldiers go home and people feel alone. And then a recurrence, which is a crisis. And then a terminal diagnosis and then dying. As they go through those periods, hope is continually renewed. And at the end, as people face death, well, I was going to say perhaps when I'm most useful, because I look at death as a doorway. What are you hoping for? Who do you hope that you'll see? If people don't believe in an afterlife, which some people don't at all, what kind of a legacy do you want to leave? So there's always hope. There's always ways to move forward through stress and through their own sadness.
So tell us a little bit about your book, Calming the Emotional Storm of Breast Cancer. I know you have a story about the inception of this book or its publication. So tell us about that and also how some of what you're talking about right now is perhaps in the book for its readers.
I was asked to write a chapter in a book by a series of physicians that I worked with. The book was called Living and Thriving with Breast Cancer. And I wrote this chapter, but the focus group liked my chapter so much they pulled it out and made it its own book, which is lovely. What I'm always hoping with my writing is that it gives people hope, gives them a perspective. There's someone, I don't remember the name of this person, but I read an article in 1976 where a man with cancer spoke about the loud loneliness of cancer and the isolation that people feel, which is such a real difficult part of a cancer experience. And I'm always hoping that people, when they read what I write about cancer, will be able to find themselves in my work and also find each other, so that they don't feel so alone.
So that's a very valuable thing writing can do. We're connected through writing to people who lived hundreds of years before us. So you're bringing that gift to the audience you serve. Speaking about focus group, liking your chapter so much they made a book, most of us as writers don't have that experience. So who was the focus group and how did that work?
When I started with this oncology practice, there were four oncologists. And when I left and retired, there were 40. So near the end of when I was working with them in the last 5 years or so is when one of the radiation oncologists named Christopher Lee in Spokane at Cancer Care Northwest, he's the one who decided to write these books. And so he gathered physicians that he knew from the practice and from around the country to work on these books with him. And then he published them. So when they picked up this book, he published it.
I see.
Yeah.
So it's a very big endeavor.
Yeah. And the nice thing about these books is that their cost is paid for by the pharmaceutical companies. And then these books are spread out free for people with cancer all over the country in waiting rooms. So it's a way to really get the word out to lots and lots of people.
It's a really, really interesting project. Yeah. That's great. Well, when we were talking before we went to more formally talk in the program, you mentioned that I might ask you how you came to writing, if you enjoy writing, and what the challenges are.
Yeah.
So why don't we tackle those three big questions?
Okay. Well, when I think about how I came to writing, my first thought always is when I was a little girl, about 12, and I was at a sleepaway camp. And my father sent my letters back to me with red ink correcting me.
He sent them back to camp?
Yes, with a letter of his own about things that you'd say to a little girl about camp. My mother found out about this, because he hadn't told her he'd done this, because he knew what she would do. She was furious at him and yelled at him, if she never writes you another letter in her life, I'll know why. But I never was offended by that. My father taught English in college. He was a Shakespeare and Tolstoy scholar. So he was very interested in writing and always encouraged us. When I used to have trouble writing, he would say, tell me what you want to say. Say it out loud. That's how you need to write it. Speak to me and then write. So he was a great coach, a writing coach.
That is the funniest writing story I've heard in a while.
Yeah.
And so did you learn from his red marks on your letters?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I used to be a big letter writer.
Mm-hmm.
And my letters were stories. And people have often told me how much they loved my letters. And boy, since email, I really don't write as many letters, but I'd love to get back to that.
A lot of us say that there's some art in it that
is
missing.
One of the great joys in my work about writing for me has been helping people write legacy letters as they're dying. And these are letters to people that they love that they're leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Letters including my favorite stories about you, things I learned from you, my greatest hopes and wishes for you in your life. I tell them not to extract promises, like don't grieve for me and be happy, stuff like that, because that's not fair. But helping people write those legacy letters is a great joy for me. And I can help them edit them as we go.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
The most difficult one was in some ways typical, because people have such a very difficult time writing these letters. I ended up making a handout with ideas they might want to include, because they just go blank when they think about writing these letters to say goodbye to people they love, and they put it off. And one woman was a single parent of a 9-year-old and could not do it and really wanted to be able to do it, but could not do it because she, like many people, felt that if she did it, she'd be then ready to die and okay to die, and she didn't want to die. So I remember realizing she was dying and it was coming close, and I went to the hospital and sat with her, and I'll call her Mary, and I said, Mary, we need to do this now if you want to get it done. You talk, I'll write, because she was too weak to write. And she talked these beautiful words to her daughter. And then I said, now you sign it, because I've written it, but you sign it. And she signed the letter and the pen fell off the page and she died.
Well, you can see I have tears in my eyes.
Yeah, it's amazing. People don't realize the power of the written word in their legacy letters. They just don't realize them. They don't realize the impact of them on people they're leaving behind.
Yeah. So your template is available somewhere besides when you work privately with people?
It certainly will be included in the book I'm writing now.
Good. And that book is called?
Right now it's Cancer's Healing Journey, Navigating the Predictable Crisis Points.
It'll be something like that, even if that's not the title.
And we can look for it
with your name, Tess Taft, T-A-F-T.
Yeah.
Thank you. So those are challenges that people writing legacy letters have faced, and you've helped them and coached them through. Do you like writing?
Probably like many people you talk to. I love it and I hate it. When I'm in the zone, it's ecstatic. I have this sense I'm getting just what I want down on the page. And my goal is always to invite people in to my writing. I've been teaching at two universities for many years, and the first time I taught, I was asked to write three syllabi for classes I was going to teach. The department gave me some examples of syllabi. They were just boring.
Yes.
And I thought a syllabus should be a teaching tool. It should be something that people read and they say, oh my gosh, I want to take that class. They should be learning right from when they read the syllabus.
I totally agree.
And so I wrote these three syllabi, which she said were wonderful, and I was delighted with that. The challenge for me is that when I talk with people, when I talk with clients that we're families, there's immediate feedback. I know immediately where we're going. With this, it feels like I'm writing into a void. And you don't get feedback until it's done writing.
Right.
So it feels like I'm writing into a void. The other thing is, for me, a lot of times, to be able to write, I need to talk with someone first. I have a wonderful friend named Lynn Walters who does that for me. I talk to her about
following your father's advice.
Yeah, and then I write it. So once I've said it, it's easier to write. Mm-hmm. Part of the challenge for me is that both my parents were very good writers. My father, though, was a scholar and was asked to write for many years. And he refused to. He said, I'm a teacher. I'm not a writer. I'm a teacher. Hmm. And my mother, when she retired, wrote a book.
What was her book?
Her book was about how to teach kids in high school how to love to read.
Hmm. So you come from a family of writers and teachers.
Yeah. And she wrote this book. She poured herself into it and got long letters back from publishers saying, it's wonderful, but it's not how literature is taught nowadays. Used to be the way you taught it, which is, what is this author trying to say? Now what they want you to talk about is, how does this author's writing make you feel? And that wasn't her focus at all. So it didn't get published. So there was great frustration. Yeah. In fact, more than one of them said, bring it back in 20 years. Well, she was 65 when she wrote that.
Maybe you can bring it back.
It's sitting in my sister's basement.
Yeah, well.
So maybe I'll bring it. That's a good idea.
Yeah. The pendulum swings.
Yeah.
In every field. So you've managed to solve the problem a little bit about writing into the void by being able to talk with a receptive person.
Yes.
And the last thing about enjoying it, you enjoy it and you hate it, but you solve your problems, the hating problems. And then what about the challenges? Is that the biggest challenge, writing into the void?
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Sheila is talking with Port Townsend oncology therapist Tess Taft about how counseling her clients living with cancer diagnoses led her to become a writer.
One of the things that I have insisted on is not having a deadline, which is a blessing and a bane, because there was somebody who said, success can only happen if we don't have quite enough time.
I write to deadline. And I'm appreciative of that.
Yeah, I might need to do that because Christopher Lee, who published these books, is very willing to publish this book when I get it done. But time goes by and the dishes need doing and the dishwasher needs unloading. And it's always easier to do those urgent things that need happening right now than it is to sit down.
Right. And they're a kind of avoidance thing. Yeah. But a lot of us writers have rituals, things that we have to prepare or have ready before we can actually clear the space. And my own feelings about that are when you sit down to write, you don't know exactly what's going to happen on the page. And you can get to a pretty chaotic place and then have to go down into an abyss and come back up.
Yes.
And I can't do that unless other things are in order. I think what I'm doing is preparing myself as best I can. Maybe you do too with the dishwasher.
I write on the dining room table. I have to clear off the table. It's got to be everything off so that I can lay things out. I need to write in a room where I can look out a window and stare at nothing.
Well, I hope that you find a way to not let time go by and that you write the book, because it really does sound like it has a big audience and very valuable. And maybe you can remember when you sit down at your dining room table that Sheila said, please write that book.
Okay.
But I'm going to tell you one thing that I watched my husband do when he was writing a technical book about Macintosh networking, very different than our topics, but he would have the messiest desk in the world and he would put his arms out in front of him and spread them out and sweep the debris away. If it fell on the floor, fine, literally. And so for years, I did it mentally. I'd say, okay, clear your space. And you know, it works.
That is a good idea.
Yeah. So I'm crossing my fingers that it might help you and that we'll get that book soon. Let's go back now before the writing. We've heard about your parents and what they've done and that they taught and wrote. And how did you choose your focus in being an oncology therapist?
Well, my parents all my life told myself and my three sisters, when you grow up, you will love what you do. You will love it. They loved their work. And what they, of course, thought we would all do is love what they did for a living, which was teach literature. And I knew I didn't want to do that. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was a college dropout. I ended up, because of a urgent need for money, working in a nursing home as a nurse's aide. And during this process, I was assigned to a man with Alzheimer's. And I bathed him and I fed him and I dressed him and I talked with him and I sang to him. And he got to know me. He hadn't spoken in a couple of years. And one day, I realized he hadn't urinated all day. And I told the head nurse, who right away got him into a urologist. And I went to the office with him. And he wouldn't let go of my arm when it came time to go to the examining room. So I went with him and got him ready. The doctor came in the room, flipping a chart, didn't say hello to him, didn't say hello to me, didn't introduce himself, just sat down on his little wheelie stool and grabbed something from a drawer. And it was a catheter, and he rammed it up the man. The blood was flying. The guy was screaming. My patient was screaming. And I jumped off out of my chair and grabbed the doctor by his shoulders on his stool and pulled him back and said, you leave him alone. You're hurting him. And he looked at me like I was the stupidest creature on earth, and he said, he can't feel this. He's demented. And I got it like a lightning bolt. I work with the very ill and the dying. I advocate for them. That's what I do. And I flew back to school. And the rest is history.
It's a stirring story. And also, you were such a young woman then, if you were college age.
Oh, I was
brave.
22, 23.
Yeah. Wow.
22.
Well, I'd love to hear a sample of your writing. So you're going to read to us from...
This is from the book Calming the Emotional Storm of Breast Cancer. I started section with a whole series of quotations by people that have been dealing with cancer. And then I follow it with a section I call Tips for the Journey. So this is the Tips for the Journey. It will help if you think back on the hardest times you've already survived in your life. How did you make it through? What coping skills did you depend on? Did you need to talk or withdraw for a while? Did you allow yourself to feel sad or angry? Did gathering information help? Did you need to turn the whole thing over to the professionals to fix so that you could relax? Did you have ways to distract yourself when you needed that? Did you pray? Did you allow people who loved you to help you? How? What worked back then? Tell a trusted friend the stories of how life has taught you these skills. Think about the strengths of character you bring to this challenge. Recognize your wisdom, your inner power, your determination. What qualities did you bring to the critical times you've already survived in your life? If you're not sure, ask people who love you. They often see us more clearly than we see ourselves, especially when we are anxious. And again, tell the stories of how life taught you to find these strengths within yourself. There's a difference between grief and depression. When we grieve, we know exactly why we feel so low. When we are depressed, we often live in a cloud of unease and sadness without really knowing why. Sometimes people feel both. Things that used to bring you pleasure or even deep joy may feel empty now. Grieve through the losses that diagnosis and treatment have forced upon you. Meetings with a counselor can help you figure out where you are stuck, ways that might help you feel more centered and peaceful. Conflict often happens in families when differing ways of coping with cancer collide. It is important to allow people to cope in their own ways. For example, one person may be devastated by fears that you will die. Another may be totally focused on what you need to do to complete treatment. Or one person, in order to relax, may need to hear every update, every detail, attend all of your doctor's appointments and treatment sessions. For others, this might cause unbearable stress. The statement to avoid among family members is, "You shouldn't feel that way." Men and women have different ways of feeling and coping with breast cancer. Men often feel helpless because they can't fix the women they love and work hard to get life back to normal as quickly as possible. Women and partners can feel as though he doesn't understand or welcome their need to express fear, sadness, and anger. It helps if women can find a breast cancer support group and close friends who can listen. It helps the relationship if both partners can understand and accept that men may not always be able to accompany their partners on the emotional journey of breast cancer. It is normal to feel very frightened when breast cancer is diagnosed. It is also normal for emotions to sink below awareness at diagnosis. In a crisis, we must stay focused. However, don't be surprised later when the feelings of crisis have passed, which they will, and your feelings from diagnosis rise to the surface. If this happens, remember that your emotions are simply catching up with the rest of you. Let yourself express them with someone you trust who can simply listen without having to fix this. And please remember this, you are not the burden weighing on the people who love you. The cancer is burdening all of you. For every family, when cancer is diagnosed, the fear of death is real, painful, and lasting. What you've all lost forever is the assumption that you will die of old age. This is called anticipatory grief, and it happens when any loved one's life is threatened, whether they die from disease or not. That is part of the burden cancer places on all of you. Ask someone close to you to remind you of this, that you are not the burden when you forget it. Most people do.
Well, thank you, Tess. What I hear as a writer and a recipient of the words is how beautifully you start by asking people to remember how they've gone through crisis before and what resources they had and which ones they used, and then give us this heavier information about depression and feeling like a burden and maybe not being able to have our partner match us on the emotional journey. So just did that beautifully, just drew me right in to myself, how do I do life, and then gave me some wonderful information. So
thank you.
Thank you. I like your style, and I think it will work really, really well in your next book. I would like to know if you have any other questions that you wished I had asked you.
Well, maybe something about some of the basic beliefs I come with about cancer to this writing journey.
Okay. So how those basic beliefs show up in your writing?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
And one of them is that I believe that a belief is only what we believe to be true in the moment, and that they change and they grow and they need space to breathe. They need room to change and permission to change. People come to me and I always ask them, why do you think you got cancer? And something I've noticed is that women usually blame in, I didn't handle my stress well enough. And men usually blame out, what the hell was I exposed to? What gave me cancer? When I talk with people about beliefs, I talk to them about what belief needs to go so that this new belief can take root. What belief needs to go to make space for who you're becoming now because of the cancer? And I think about that with my writing. What beliefs need to go so that I can actually sit down and finish this book?
And, you know, while you're writing, beliefs come and go.
Yes.
You believe you're writing one thing, and the words are telling you you're actually writing something else.
Yes.
And what do you have to let go in order to let the words be smarter than we
are? Let go of my own agenda that's in my head and let it come from a deeper place.
Yes.
Instead of my brains, from my wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
But I think living requires hanging on for dear life, and dying requires letting go. Mm. And there's that gray area in between. And that's like writing, too. What do I need to hang on to? What do I need to let go? And there's that gray, confusing period in the middle.
Absolutely.
When things are coming and going and shifting. And It's like walking on quicksand. Right.
And how do you know the difference is my question. But you mentioned being in flow. I don't know if you use that word, but the times when the writing's coming and how ecstatic that can feel. Something can happen, and then it's almost like we're not having that question. That grayness sort of just
goes away.
Yeah. And it doesn't seem to be anything we've done exactly. Do you have any words on that? Because that is one of the mysteries of writing, and it sounds like it's one of the mysteries of how you help people.
Well, I think that there's much more going on in our decision-making than we are aware of. I believe that the world is multidimensional. I believe that people who love us that have died are with us, guiding our path. Many people don't believe that, but after working with people that are dying and being part of witnessing long conversations that I hear one half of in the days before someone dies because they're talking to someone else who's died, I think that's important. So one of the rituals I have before I write is to ask for guidance from all the sources of love that come to me. That helps me really get into the focus.
I love that. And I love that I can see you opening your arms and holding them up towards the heavens.
Yeah.
And I think that if we can do both rituals, spreading our arms out, putting the debris away, and then raising our arms to the heavens and asking for those voices.
Yes.
How beautiful. I want to thank you so, so very much for being here with us today.
Welcome.
And I want to wish you Godspeed in writing the next book.
Thank you very much.
And I want to repeat the title of your book for people who are interested in it, Calming the Emotional Storm of Breast Cancer. And the next one you told us
is Cancer's Healing Journey, Navigating the Predictable Crisis.
So what if you don't have to go to a doctor right now? Say your loved one isn't seeing a local doctor, but you would like to read this book. Can they go into an oncologist's office and find this literature?
I don't know if the oncologists here have these books, but they can certainly go onto Amazon.
Oh, good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.